grateful for again permitting us the opportunity to continue our advance to Santa Fe. It is our prayer that as we ride the trail, we would note certain exigencies faced by our forefathers and be able to read into them certain spiritual principles that assist us in the angelic conflict. It is to that end that we continue our study and pray for the power of the Spirit to discern these things. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. We were able to introduce the concept of the two legs of the latter phase of the Santa Fe Trail, the mountain route being one we noted the other time we met, Sunday, I believe. And then, of course, the Cimarron Cutoff, which is what we're going to look at first. And the second rider that we're noting is William B. Napton. That's William B. Napton, Jr. He is the great-grandfather of Melinda Smith and our congregation. And his book, which was originally published in 1905, has been reproduced by Friends of Arrow Rock. And there's the date on it right there. There is a bit of a historic trail, I would gather, over around Arrow Rock that centers around many of the pioneer activities that took place a century and a half ago. And quite a number of historical sites are in evidence there. There is, I understand, a gift shop where these books are actually on sale. And Melinda gave me a copy, and I read it. And our next increment on the Cimarron Cutoff will come from his writings from the chapter to the Cimarron. And I'll begin the excerpts on page 33. He said, good headway was made by the trains up to the Arkansas until we reached the lower crossing. Now, I need to take a moment to show you a bit about what he means by that. There was really no established trail as far as the Cimarron Cutoff was concerned. I noted on Sunday that the caches is where we just left, and we move up the road, and you can cross over down toward the Cimarron River along here, and there's another crossing here. And note, they mention the Hornada or the water scrape in this particular area. This is a very treacherous desert region for about 40 to 60 miles down through here. Now, these are called the middle crossings, but Napton mentions here that they took the lower crossing, and I need to explain that. And we'll go to a couple of maps here. Dodge City is right over in this neck of the woods, and you'll note that you come down the Santa Fe Trail over here from a couple of directions, and you hit the Arkansas River right along through here. And this is the lower crossing. They actually cut down into the Hornada early before getting past Dodge City. Now, this is the particular route that Napton and his party took. Now, we have been describing the middle routes. This is Dodge City here, and then you can see the middle routes coming off of the Santa Fe Trail, which continues on up the Arkansas toward Colorado. And dropping down at a couple of sites here, they enter the Hornada. So back on this side of Dodge City is what's called the lower route, and that's the one Napton's party took. He said it had been determined by the wagon masters that that would be the crossing on the river that they would take. Although the river was fordable, it was quite tedious and difficult to get the heavily loaded wagons across the stream, the water being waist deep and the bottom uneven. Neither an ox nor a mule will pull when he gets into water touching his body. The mule, under such circumstances, always has a tendency to fall down and so get drowned by becoming entangled in the harness. To meet this emergency, the ox teams were doubled, 10 yoke being hitched to each wagon, and were urged to do their duty by a half dozen drivers on each side, wading through the water beside them. Now, he doesn't get into any more detail about what these wagon masters were doing. He calls them drivers, a half dozen drivers. I would like to go briefly to another publication entitled The Santa Fe Trail, Voyage of Discovery, written by Dan Murray. He has a quote here that I think puts things in perspective as to what these drivers actually had to do when they were getting these mules and oxen across a river. They didn't want to go, the animals didn't, and they had to be encouraged. Now, there was a shipping firm that had one of its partners named William Waddell. And William Waddell is off on one of these Santa Fe Trail missions, and he is confronted with getting teams across one of these rivers that they've encountered, and they're not making too much progress. And one of these wagon masters, so to speak, wagoners in other cases, tells him the following in order to try and get him to permit a little more flexibility in getting these animals across. Now, this unnamed wagoneer looks at Waddell and says the following: "Boss, the trouble with them oxen is that they don't understand the kind of language we're talking to them. Plain gee and haw ain't enough under the present circumstances. Now, if you could just find it convenient to go off on that hill somewhere so you couldn't hear what was going on, I'd undertake to get them oxen out." And that's indeed, I assume, what Waddell did. Now, precisely what do these wagoneers do? The article says that generals have stars. The bullwhacker has his whip. This was no carnival whip we see today. It was a monster suitable to driving oxen or mules dragging 3 tons up the slope of the prairie to the Rocky Mountains. In the days of the professionals, the whip started with a 3 or 4 foot stock of heavy wood and then a braided rawhide lash that could be 20 feet long. On the end was a replaceable popper, an 8-inch piece of rawhide that could crack like a pistol shot and could cut hide like a knife. But that was not the point of it. A teamster bragged if he could get to Santa Fe and back without drawing blood. The point was to pop it at just the right spot by the correct animal's left or right ear to guide and inspire him. So these bullwhackers played that whip like a violin, and you have 10 oxen out in front of you, 5 yoke usually per team. And if there's one of them fouling up and he needed to go right and he was going left, they were able to reach out with that whip and pop it by his left ear and goad him back into the proper wheel track. You see how all this works. A beautiful example of what God does to us on occasion. When you hear the crack, you know it's time to change wheel tracks. And that was the case for these oxen. See, we're dumb as mules and oxen, you see. Well, I'll return now to Napton. The greater part of the day was taken up in getting the wagons across, but it was accomplished without serious loss. Everything being over, we encamped at the foot of the hill on the opposite side and rested a day in recognition of the 4th of July. We fired some shots, and Captain Childs brought forth from his trunk some jars of gooseberries, directing the cooks to make some pies. The gooseberries were all right, but the pie crust would have given an ostrich a case of indigestion. The old Santa Fe Trail from the lower crossing of the Arkansas ran southwest to the Cimarron, across a stretch of country where there was no water for a distance of nearly 60 miles. All the water casks were filled from the Arkansas River for the use of the men, but of course there was no means of carrying water for horse or ox. The weather was warm and dry, and now we were about to enter upon the Jornada, the Spanish word for dry stretch. Intending to drive all night, starting was postponed until near sundown. 2 or 3 miles from the Arkansas, we apparently reached the general attitude of the plains over which we trudged during the whole night, with nothing but the rumbling of the wagons and the occasional shout of one of the drivers to break the silence of the plains. The approach of morning and the rising of the sun like a ball of fire emerged from the endless plain to the east of us as from the ocean, soon overwhelming us with a flood of light such as I had never experienced before. During all that day's march, the heat was intense, and the sunlight almost blinding, the kind of weather that creates the mirage of the plains. In the distance, on either hand, fine lakes of clear water were seen glistening in the sun, sometimes appearing circular in shape, surrounded with the proper shores, the illusion being apparently complete, so much so that several times during the day I rode some distance seeking to ascertain if they were really lakes or not. I found them receding as I approached and was unable to get any closer to them than when, as a boy, I set out to find the sack of gold at the end of the rainbow. In the afternoon of the second day from the Arkansas, we reached Sand Creek, a tributary of the Cimarron, where we found a pool of stagnant water, not enough for the oxen, but sufficient for the trainsmen to make coffee with, and there we camped. A few hours afterwards, we struck the valley of the Cimarron, and after riding up the bed of the apparently dry stream, we discovered a pool of clear water. The cattle were so famished that they ran into the pool, hitched to the wagons, their drivers being unable to restrain them, and it was with considerable difficulty that the wagons were afterwards pulled out of the mud. The third account of crossing the Jornada comes from our old friend Josiah Gregg, Commerce of the Prairies, beginning on page 49. He says, our route had already led us up the course of the Arkansas River for over 100 miles, yet the earlier caravans often passed from 50 to 100 miles further before crossing the river. As I pointed out to you a moment ago, there are three ways to cross. We note that Napton crossed on the lower crossing. There are two crossings that we note on this particular map, and around the caches is the middle cutoff, really, and there's another one right along here. So they're taking what really amounts to the middle cutoff. He says, nor was there a road, not even a trail anywhere across the famous plain extending between the Arkansas and Cimarron rivers, a distance of over 50 miles, which now lay before us, the scene of such frequent sufferings in former times of want of water. That stretch between, say, Dodge City and Fort Union, there was a trail once you got to further toward New Mexico, but for that first 40 to 60 miles, there just wasn't much of a trail at all. And as he will point out in a few moments, your trail guide was your compass. And without that, you couldn't make it. There were no landmarks. Everything looked the same. Everyone describes it as a sandy ocean. And if you've ever been out at sea, fortunately, I never have, but I've seen movies. And you can look in any direction, and there's nothing but water. And there's nothing to orient to if you don't know how to use the stars and the compass. And that's pretty much what it was like on the Jornada for this stretch. And you could become disoriented, especially in the heat of the day. You get disoriented from the heat. You don't know which direction you're going. And you could wind up going around in circles out there. And many did. So a compass was very important. Gregg goes on to say, it having been determined upon, however, to strike across this dreaded desert the following morning, the whole party was busy in preparing for the water scrape, as these droughty drives are very appropriately called by prairie travelers. This tract of country may truly be styled the Grand Prairie Ocean, for not a single landmark is to be seen for more than 40 miles, scarcely a visible eminence by which to direct one's course. All is as level as the sea, and the compass was our surest as well as principal guide. For the first 5 miles, we had a heavy pull among the sandy hillocks, but soon the broad and level plain opened before us. The next day, we fortunately had a heavy shower, which afforded us abundance of water. Having also swerved considerably toward the south, we fell into a more uneven section of country where we had to cross a brook swelled by the recent rain into which one of the wagons was unfortunately overset. We were now compelled to make a halt, and all hands flocked to the assistance of the owner of the damaged cargo. We now moved on slowly and leisurely, for all anxiety on the subject of water had been happily set at rest by frequent falls of rain. But imagine our consternation and dismay when, upon descending into the valley of the Cimarron on the morning of the 19th of June, a band of Indian warriors on horseback suddenly appeared before us from behind the ravines, an imposing array of death-dealing savages. There was no merriment in this. It was a genuine alarm, a tangible tragedy. These warriors, however, as we soon discovered, were only the vanguard of a countless host who were by this time pouring over the opposite ridge and galloping directly toward us. The wagons were soon irregularly formed upon the hillside, but in accordance with the habitual carelessness of caravan traders, a great portion of the men were unprepared for the emergency. Scores of guns were empty, and as many more had been wetted by the recent showers and would not go off. Here was one calling for bullets, another for powder, a third for flint. Exclamations such as, "I've broke my ramrod, I've split my caps, I've rammed down a ball without powder, my gun is choked, give me yours," these exclamations were heard from different quarters. While a timorous greenhorn would perhaps cry out, "Here, take my gun, you can outshoot me." The more daring bolted off to encounter the enemy at once, shouting, "Skin that smoke wagon and see what happens. Where are you going with that shotgun? You wretched slugs, doesn't any of you want to have the guts to play for blood?" While the timid and cautious took a stand with presented rifle behind the wagon, saying, "Nah ain't the time." The Indians, who were in advance, made a bold attempt to press upon us, which came near costing them dearly. For some of our fiery backwoodsmen more than once had their rusty but unerring rifles directed upon the intruders, some of whom would inevitably have fallen before their deadly aim had not a few of the more prudent traitors interposed. The savages made demonstrations no less hostile, rushing with ready-sprung bows upon a portion of our men who had gone in search of water, and mischief would perhaps have ensued had not the impetuosity of the warriors been checked by the wise men of the tribe. The Indians were collecting around us in great numbers that it was deemed expedient to force them away so as to either resume our march or at least to take a more advantageous position. Our company was therefore mustered and drawn up in line of battle, and accompanied by the sound of a drum and a fife, we marched toward the main group of the Indians. The latter, the Indians, seemed far more delighted than frightened by this strange parade in music, a spectacle they had no doubt never witnessed before. But whatever may have been their impressions, one thing is certain: that the principal chief appeared to have full confidence in the virtues of his calumet, which is defined as a ceremonial pipe, but amounts to a bong. He lighted it up, came boldly forward to meet our warlike corps, serenely smoking his pipe of peace. Our captain, now taking a whiff with the savage chief, directed him by signs to cause his warriors to retire. This most of them did, to rejoin the long train of squaws and papooses with the baggage who followed in their rear and were just then seen emerging from behind the hills. Having slowly descended to the banks of the stream, they pitched their wigwams, or lodges, over 500 of which soon bespeckled the ample valley before us and at once gave to its recently meager surface the aspect of an immense Indian village. The entire number of the Indians, when collected together, could not have been less than from 2,000 to 3,000. In such a case, they must have mustered nearly 1,000 warriors, while we were but a little over 200 strong. Still, our superior arms and the protection afforded by the wagons gave us considerably the advantage. However, the appearance of the squaws and children soon convinced us that, for the present at least, they had no hostile intentions, so we also descended into the valley and formed our camp a few hundred yards below theirs. Although we were now on the very banks of the Cimarron itself, even the most experienced traders of our party, whether through fright or ignorance, seemed utterly unconscious of the fact. Having made our descent far below the usual point of approach, and there being not a drop of water found in the Sandy River's bed, it was mistaken for Sand Creek, which runs north of and parallel to the Cimarron, and we accordingly proceeded onward without noticing it. Well, these are just a few of the exigencies our frontier friends encountered as they traveled the Cimarron cutoff. We will note a few which have doctrinal implications. We begin with this latter encounter with the Indians, which brings out a few doctrinal principles that are applicable whether observed in a small context of a prairie skirmish or magnified to the maximum level of international confrontations. Therefore, our first doctrine we will note on the Horonata is the importance of military preparedness and the right to bear arms. Let's first note the several comments by Gregg which indicate certain strengths and weaknesses apparent among the frontiersmen as well as the Indians. Point one. It was noted by Gregg that the Indians suddenly appeared on horseback. Several of these will have sub-points. Sub-point one. This is interesting. Apparently, due to complacency and overconfidence based on treaties signed with the Osage and Kaw Indians, the pioneers failed to practice the common law of the prairies during the daytime. There was no vanguard. And I guess they assumed there were no Indians on the Horonata, but these guys had learned how to live there. So it's interesting to note that at nighttime they would post sentries, and that was considered to be the law of the prairies, that at night you posted sentries, you had a vanguard. And under point two, I'll remind you that back at Council Grove, Gregg related to us this information. I'll quote again, "There is nothing so much dreaded by the inexperienced travelers as the ordeal of guard duty. But no matter what the condition or employment of the individual may be, no one has the smallest chance of evading the common law of the prairies. Everybody pulled guard duty." Now the question arises, why didn't they have a vanguard during the day? They didn't, and therefore the Indians were able to suddenly appear. So point three, without requiring a vanguard to watch the train's outer periphery, this nomadic community of wagons is required to orient without warning to an overt hostile attack. Orient without warning to an overt hostile attack. They were caught by surprise. Now, they constitute a community. 200-plus people are traveling down a lawless trail. And there are dangers out there, and they know it, and they didn't prepare accordingly. And they wind up with a problem. Point two. Gregg refers to this as, quote, a tangible reality. Was it ever? Now, please note that soon after the warriors crested the hill, and after they had had this near bloody shootout, then came the women and the children. Now, these Indians, had they been convinced that their women and children were in danger, would have engaged the pioneers. And isn't it interesting that they, the Indians, who outnumbered the pioneers 5-1, were at the disadvantage. They were at the disadvantage, and this is one of the principles we're going to pound home throughout this section of our study. We're going to note armies in the Bible who were completely outnumbered but victorious. We're going to note armies of the United States of America who were outnumbered but victorious. And when it's all done, we're going to note the spiritual warfare of the angelic conflict and how we are outnumbered, But greater is He that is in us than he that is in the world. So there are a lot of applications to all of this, and we'll note them one by one. Well, we have a tangible reality here. First subpoint under point two. When lack of preparation causes outside adversity to create a sudden change of circumstances, then one is faced with the ordeal of immediate adjustment. When lack of preparation causes outside adversity to create a sudden change of circumstances, then one is faced with the ordeal of immediate adjustment. Now, in the angelic conflict, this occurs when events pop up on emerging from the divine decrees and appearing in your life that you are completely unprepared for. And you look at it and say, I don't want to do this today. You're unprepared. And the way to defend your soul, the way a country would defend its citizens, the way a party on the plains would defend its wagons and its people, is to get artillery of thought in the soul ready for application on a moment's notice. It is no good at all to be riding down the trail and to be caught flat-footed, unprepared, and not knowing what to do. And so we have here a lack of preparation. We have an outside adversity, and it has caused a sudden change of circumstances, and the wagoneers, the people on this particular wagon train, are faced with the ordeal of immediate adjustment. Point two. Caught off guard and ill prepared, they suffer the paralysis of disorientation and maladjustment. We are to orient and adjust to changing circumstances of life by application of pertinent doctrine. If you don't have the doctrine, when these events occur in your life, you will be, first of all, disoriented, and because of that, you will have maladjustment. And it usually starts in the emotional complex of sin. For example, we go back to the last paragraph that I read to you from Greg, and all of the skirmish is over. And he says, although we were now on the very banks of the Cimarron, even the most experienced traders of our party, whether through fright or ignorance, see, that's an emotional problem. Because of this sudden encounter with the Indians, people were afraid, their nerves were on end, and they lost concentration. And as a result of that, they assumed because the riverbed was dry, it was the Sand River rather than the Cimarron, which was their target. And they kept riding south, thinking that they had yet to go a bit further to get to the Cimarron. Now, that's an emotional problem, and that is maladjustment. Subpoint three. Blame can be placed on facilitated wheel tracks of wickedness. And no question that when you disorient because of emotion, it is a wheel track of wickedness. Point three. Greg refers to this as the, quote, habitual carelessness of the traitors. Habitual. They facilitated this carelessness, and therefore causing them to be, quote, unprepared for the emergency. Facilitated wheel tracks of wickedness produce being unprepared for an emergency. And that's what happened to these guys. Now, this is on the Cimarron cutoff. These are our forefathers 150 plus years ago. Subpoint one. Poor decisions facilitate a careless lifestyle which limits one's future options for preparedness under pressure. Poor decisions facilitate a careless lifestyle which limits one's future options for preparedness under pressure. You let your guard down. There's a gospel song. The shield does you no good if it's hanging by your side. get the shield of faith before you. That shows that you have forgotten the major law of the prairie. You're not putting up a defense. You're not cognizant of the fact that you're in the midst of a hostile situation, that there are problems that can emerge at any moment. And believers must orient to the concept that the angelic conflict rages on a daily basis and the believer gets cut no slack. And the way that we're challenged, our outside adversities have to do with the erroneous thought of the day. We are being bombarded by erroneous thought, and you have to learn to identify that and then adjust to it. You get caught flat-footed when people come up to you and present you with a piece of information that you've never thought of before, and you don't have a solution at that moment. And you either come up with it or you blow it. It's a rock and roll. I mean, we win some, we lose some. But that is the order of the day for the angelic conflict, and we accumulate this information that God has provided for us so that over a period of time, we have this huge arsenal of thoughts available for recall at a moment's notice under pressure, and we can win in the angelic conflict a majority of the time, although we are at a numerical disadvantage. There are far, far more unbelievers than there are believers. And among the believing population of the world, there are far, far more reversionists than there are those who are making the advance. We are definitely in a small, small number, yet we have the power to win over all of the exigencies within the angelic conflict. These are the kinds of thoughts that will emerge from our study here. And so poor decisions facilitate a careless lifestyle which limits one's future options for preparedness under pressure. Subpoint 2. A nation which becomes careless in the recruitment, support, training, and deployment of its military defenses is a nation which is in the process of becoming unprepared for the emergency. A nation which becomes careless in the recruitment, support, training and deployment of its military defenses is a nation which is in the process of becoming unprepared for the emergency. It might be termed by Gregg habitual carelessness of the citizens. Now I have two articles I want to bring to your attention. Each is going to dramatize one particular area of our national unpreparedness. One will dramatize how our military is being in many ways diluted and therefore unprepared for combat. And the second will note how our hardware, our ordnance, is being diminished and thus unprepared for any potential future conflict. Now, the first one is going to be an excerpt from Robert H. Bork's book, Feminism, or rather Slouching Towards Gomorrah is the name of the book, and excerpts will come from the chapter, Feminism Conquers America's Armed Forces. I'll read a few excerpts beginning on page 218. He says, feminists advance two arguments for their disastrous policy toward the military. One is that putting women in combat is crucial to women's self-esteem and to men's respect for women. That has never been true in the past, and it is impossible to see why it should be true now. The other, more effective argument in today's egalitarian culture is that combat roles are important to military advancement. With that observation, feminists have framed the terms of the debate as one about fairness and the equality of women. The question of whether equality in the military is worth the loss of additional lives and the decrease in our armed forces' fighting capability has virtually been ruled out of bounds as sexist. In other words, you can't debate the issue with regard to efficiency of our forces. That is a sexist argument, and thus, in the concept that they control the rules of the debate, that may not be brought into the discussion. Then he says, it has been entirely ruled out of bounds within the military. The military is to be used as a means of reforming society and not exclusively as the means of defending our country and our interests around the world. The inevitable result is that training standards are lowered, and that fact is then ferociously denied. That has apparently already cost one woman her life, Navy Lieutenant Kara Hultgren. One of the first female fighter pilots was killed in October of 1994 on an approach landing to a carrier ship off the coast of San Diego. While the Navy was saying publicly that Hultgren was blameless, privately it had reached a different conclusion. Pilot error, not engine failure, was the principal cause of the crash. Political expedience, however, made it unwise to say so. And the real media story was that so few reporters wanted to know. Unfortunately, those in the best position to testify on this subject, our career officers, would destroy their careers if they spoke objectively, so they are forced into silence or to repeating the feminist line. Another example. On July 26, 1994, Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Karkoff's superior officer recommended him for early promotion ahead of his peers because he was, quote, an extraordinary department head, a superior officer in charge with unlimited potential, destined for command and beyond, end quote. 6 weeks later, that same superior revised Karkoff's fitness report to downgrade him in every category and to rate his, quote, overall performance as unsatisfactory, unquote, so that he could not be recommended for promotion or even retention in the Navy. The intervening event that caused this drastic reevaluation was that Karkoff, in a private conversation with his commanding officer, had said that his religious views made him doubtful about putting women in combat, though those views also required him to lead women into combat if ordered to do so by his superiors. That remark led to the revised report, which criticized him for, quote, his inability to fully employ and impartially judge the female members of his helicopter unit, end quote. The superior summed matters up quite succinctly. Another quote, a bright future has been lost and otherwise superb performance completely overshadowed by this glaring, irreconcilable conflict with Navy policy, end quote. Even if you are willing to lead women into combat, your thought that that might not be suitable is sufficient to end your career. The Navy Separation Board voted to discharge the lieutenant commander. The Navy threw away a man of great ability and gained peace with the feminists. With such threats hanging over their heads, it is not surprising that career officers do not speak out about the performance of women in combat positions. It is not just the Navy that has been cowed. Though it is not discussed publicly, training in the other services has been made less arduous in order to accommodate women, and problems experienced in the field go unreported. One thing I've learned to do on the news when they interview a career officer or any officer regarding one of these very touchy political issues, you cannot believe a word they say. They are forced into lying. Men who are taught to tell the truth, duty, honor, country, truth conquers all, men who are taught that from the first day they enlist, are now trained to lie to the media in order to remain politically correct. I think that interesting. There's another dichotomy coming up you'll find interesting too. Now here are a few of the problems. There is a term called gender norming. Gender norming is now the rule at all three service academies so that women are measured against other women rather than against men who outperform them. The official position at West Point is that there have been no negative effects from the admission of women, but a Heritage Foundation study draws on the sworn courtroom testimony of a West Point official that women cannot perform nearly as well as men, and that the men's training program has, for that reason, been downgraded. For example, men are no longer required to run carrying heavy weapons because women are unable to do that. The Army has not released detailed information on programs with female troops during the battle with the Iraqis. Pregnancies due to sex during Desert Shield was the primary reason the non-deployability rate of women was many times higher than that of men in Desert Storm. 3, Top Gun flight commanders had their careers destroyed because they performed in the Tomcat Follies, which included a rhyme denigrating Pat Schroeder. President Bush and Vice President Quayle were also lampooned, but only parodying a fiercely feminist congresswoman was conceived as a grave offense. In physical fitness tests, very few women could do even one pull-up, so the Air Force Academy gave credit for the amount of time they could hang on the bar. Female cadets averaged almost 4 times as many visits to the medical clinic as male cadets. At West Point, the female cadets' injury rate in field training was 14 times that of the men, and 61% of women failed to complete physical tests compared to 4.8% of the men. During Army basic training, women broke down in tears, particularly on the rifle range. Navy ships have had to be recalled from missions because of the pregnancy of female soldiers. The Navy said there was no indication that any of the pregnancies resulted from sex on board the ship. So they have to lie about this. Those who wish to may believe that. Only someone who has never been with troops could not anticipate this result or fail to realize that it will be a major problem forever. The troops in question are very young, at an age when their hormones are, to put it mildly, fiercely insistent. The presence of women among male troops weakens combat readiness. All male units in the field experience bonding that enhances unit cohesion and effectiveness. When women are introduced, men stop relating to each other and begin trying to attract the women. Nor can morale be improved when accusations of harassment are always a threat. Male officers leave the office door open or have a third person in the room when dealing with a female subordinate. An accusation of sexual harassment by the woman, even if unproven, would severely damage the man's service career. And both the man and the woman are acutely aware of that fact. Representative Pat Schroeder demanded and got sexual harassment training for all personnel in order to rid the Navy of, quote, bad attitudes. The Israelis, Soviets, and Germans, when in desperate need of frontline troops, placed women in combat, but later barred them. Male troops forgot their tactical objectives in order to protect the women from harm or capture, knowing that the enemy would do to female prisoners in time of war. This made combat units less effective and exposed the men to even greater risks. Our military seems quite aware of such dangers, but because of the feminists, it would be politically dangerous to respond as the Israelis did by taking women out of harm's way. Instead, the American solution is to try to stifle the natural reactions of men. The Air Force, for example, established a mock prisoner of war camp to desensitize male recruits so they won't react like men when women prisoners scream under torture. Now, I want you to get that sentence. We have here the Air Force. They have established a mock prisoner of war camp. The reason for this mock camp, to desensitize male recruits so they won't react like men when women prisoners scream under torture. Now get this next sentence. There is a very considerable anomaly here. The military is training men to be more sensitive to women in order to prevent sexual harassment, and also training men to be insensitive to women being raped and sodomized or screaming under torture. It is impossible to believe that both efforts can succeed simultaneously. Political intimidation by radical feminists is so powerful that there seems little prospect that the continuing feminization of the U.S. military can be reversed. Little prospect of this being reversed. At least not until some engagements are lost or won at unacceptably high costs, and women and the men who tried to protect them begin coming back in great numbers in body bags. And that's a good point, a horrific point, but true. Now, my point by bringing that to you is to show you that we are systematically destroying our military preparedness, and it is in a time of a great deal of international unrest. Because of the fall of the Soviet Union, there is this idea floating about that we need to banish all nuclear weapons. Now, we're willing to do that as a nation. Russia claims they're doing it, but God only knows what's happening to the weapons and all of the parts that go with it. And so another problem emerges with regard to weaponry. And that brings excerpts from an article which appeared in the December 1996 issue of the American Spectator. It is written by Tom Bethel, and he entitles it No Nukes America. I read only excerpts. He says, today, the entire U.S. nuclear weapons assembly line is running in reverse. All the nuclear weapons production facilities are closed down, and the bombs themselves, having been retrieved from silos or Air Force bases, are being brought back to the same Pantex plant where they were built, at a rate of about 35 to 40 bombs a week. They are transported across U.S. highways in unmarked, heavily guarded tractor trailers. At Pantex, they are disassembled and their plutonium pits stored in bunkers. The U.S. is said to be dismantling its arsenal at a rate of about 2,000 weapons a year. The planned final size of the arsenal is secret, but some say the total may be no more than 1,000 weapons. In the post-war period, the U.S. produced some 70,000 nuclear weapons, or about 75 different types. The elimination of superfluous arsenals, by definition, does not jeopardize security, and there is much to be said for the current bill down. But it also has its disquieting aspects. Above all, it will be difficult to reverse the present course. In an emergency, it could be done, but by then it would be too late in view of the time required to build or restart the industrial infrastructure. See, that there's where the crisis comes, and you've got this sudden appearance of a problem, you're unprepared, and you have to immediately orient and adjust. And when you have to get industry up and running, this can't be done overnight. He goes on to say, as the Cold War was coming to an end, the environmentalists gained a crucial and little remarked ascendancy over the military in the ordering of government priorities. Weapons plants were stigmatized as contaminated sites, called hotspots, sources of hazardous waste. All of the major nuclear weapons facilities have been included on the Environmental Protection Agency's Superfund National Priorities List of the worst contaminated sites in America. In preparing to fight a nuclear war with the former Soviet Union, the magazine Defense Monitor said, America succeeded in nuking itself. It is an irony, surely, that the plants that arguably yielded a 50-year stretch of domestic peace, rarely enjoyed by any nation, should in the end have to be so condemned. In order to gain insight into future nuclear weapons policy, it is worth studying the tracts, the writings, of the anti-nukes. Their goal is unmistakable. America is to be a nuclear-free zone. The present deconstruction of America's nukes was prescribed in their earlier manifestos, but abolition is the goal. In 1992, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists published its Agenda 2001. Here's the major thrust of that. No nukes are being built. Production facilities are shut tight. The current arsenal is being deconstructed, and the U.S. has signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That all to be accomplished by the year 2001. Bill Clinton adopted a policy of no more testing against the advice of the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Siegfried Hecker. In May of 93, he told Clinton that testing was the best way to maintain a reliable deterrent. 2 months later, Clinton nonetheless ordered an end to testing. When China proceeded with an atmospheric test a few weeks later, U.S. policymakers chose to pay no attention. Russia is reliably reported to be maintaining its production lines, perhaps assembling as many nuclear weapons a year as we are dismantling. Even the humble Brits continue with a slow but active weapons production cycle, but the U.S. has produced no nuclear weapons since the year 1990. Titanium, a hydrogen isotope that is an essential ingredient of all American nukes, has not been produced anywhere in the United States since 1988. With a half, now this gets technical, but it's important. This is tritanium. With a half-life of 12.6 years, most of the installed tritanium will have vanished into thin air by the year 2015. The main concern of those who are responsible for maintaining the nuclear arsenal today is that the needed human capital, the experience, and the know-how will dwindle away along with the tritanium. The refusal to allow further testing ensures that nuclear weapons technology will become increasingly outdated because crude bombs can be assembled without the need for testing. An end to testing enhances global security only in the minds of those who think the U.S. is the greatest threat to it. The main constraint on proliferation is the difficulty of obtaining weapons-grade material, namely highly enriched uranium and plutonium. Neither occurs in nature, and both depend for their production upon an advanced industrial capacity that itself has not yet proliferated much beyond the Western world. The uncomfortable fact is that the U.S. has pursued its undeclared policy of unilateral denuclearization at just the time when this material has become more available than ever before, thanks to the breakup of the former Soviet Union. More than 100 cases of smuggling of weapons-grade material have been detected. Will we feel more secure? Let us say 10 years from now, when more countries have acquired nuclear weapons and it sinks in that our own dwindling arsenal is untested and also of unquestionable reliability. So we have denuked and we have this proliferation of this weapons-grade materials floating around. God knows who gets it. The third world countries are most likely to be the ones to come up with it. And then we are going to confront our enemies with a bunch of women. Now, let me tell you something. It is politically incorrect for me to have read Bork's article here tonight. It is politically incorrect for me to make the comment that I just made. Fight these people with a bunch of women. Women are to be honored, revered, protected. They are not to be the individuals who go out and fight and die and bleed and become maimed for our nation's security. We are not to put women in that kind of danger. I don't care even if they want to go. They're not qualified to serve. They're not capable of being good soldiers, and they can't defend the shores. And it is immoral, and it's simply not right. These are a couple of the ways that we are being careless in the recruitment, support, training, and deployment of our military defenses. And therefore, we are in the process of becoming unprepared for the emergency. Subpoint three, this is a good way of saying that our guns are, point four, empty and wetted. Our guns are empty and wetted. That was the problem the pioneers faced when the Indians crested the hill. They got their guns together and they hadn't even bothered to load them. Those who had loaded guns, because of the rains they had just experienced, found they were wetted. The powder was wet and they couldn't fire around. And so this is a way of saying our guns are empty and wetted. Subpoint one. Unpreparedness results in vulnerability to sudden attack. Now, the sudden attack may not come today or tomorrow, but you're always vulnerable. And when it does come, you are unprepared. Point two, failure to maintain a cache of ready arms in case of emergency endangers the entire community if on a trail west, or an entire nation if in time of clandestine nuclear proliferation. Failure to maintain a cache of ready arms in case of emergency endangers the entire community if on a trail west, or an entire nation if in time of clandestine nuclear proliferation. For you personally, you're in danger, you're unprepared, you do not have a proper defense if you don't have doctrine in your soul ready to combat the exigencies of the angelic conflict. We'll continue at point five on Thursday evening, but please be prepared for a cancellation. I understand the weather may turn beastly between now and then. Father, we are grateful to you for the privilege of introducing this study in a way that focuses our attention on our responsibilities as free citizens in a client nation. As we continue to deal with this particular exigency on the trail, may we be able to focus on our own individual responsibilities as protectors of home and hearth, as citizens of a client nation, and as combatants in the angelic conflict. And we lift our prayers in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen.